Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Washington Weekly Podcast on the UBS In The Now podcast channel. Joining us for the conversation today, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Shane, thank you for joining us on a Thursday. Welcome back and looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks, Dan, and happy opening day of baseball season to you.
Absolutely. It's good to have baseball back in action. So from our last conversation, Shane, a few topics we want to cover with our listeners, our clients for this week. I recall shortly after we spoke last week, we did see news break of GOP-led efforts from within the House to remove current House Speaker Mike Johnson from office. Our listeners might recall the recent fate of former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. So with that, how and why did this materialize, and how do you see this evolving from here?
Yeah, since it's opening day of baseball season, I'll use a Yogi Berraism of it's deja vu all over again. But I actually think this is a little bit different. What happened here, and I think it's going to be different how it plays out. What happened here was Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, she filed a motion to vacate, which was the process used last year to kick then Speaker McCarthy out of his speakership. But she hasn't done all the procedural steps. So she filed this motion kind of as a warning shot to Speaker Johnson, warning him that she does not want to see a Ukraine bill on the floor when lawmakers return after this recess. Now, when they come back, you know, she could force a vote by, you know, going to the floor and requesting a vote, as what Congressman Matt Gaetz did last year with Speaker McCarthy. And that would set in motion, you know, an actual vote to vacate Johnson as the speaker. Now, I think this may play out a little differently. You know, you're already hearing some Democrats say that they're may not go along with this as they did last time. Notably, you know, Democrats who are supporting more aid to Ukraine of saying, you know, they may sit this vote out or, you know, maybe show some support for Speaker Johnson. So, you know, this is not a fait accompli where Speaker Johnson is going to be ousted like his predecessor, but this is definitely going to be something for us to pay close attention to in the coming weeks when Congress comes back into session.
Definitely appreciate the clarity, Shane, in terms of how this circumstance compares to the process we witnessed with former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Now, I do want to turn to the recent funding bill. We did see President Biden, he did proceed with signing that $1.2 trillion funding bill, which does keep the government agencies running through September 30th. So can you provide some takeaways in terms of what this bill contains, maybe some notable inclusions within as well as exclusions?
Yeah, so this bill contained about 70% of discretionary funding. And, you know, and it's outsized to its previous package that was passed into law a few weeks ago because, you know, this housed the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, which are, you know, bigger agencies and departments than that first batch that was already passed into law. You know, and there are lawmakers that believe this is too much spending, and that was part of Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's rationale for going down this road of motion to vacate. But you saw, you know, both in the House and Senate, you know, Democrats pretty widely support it, and Republicans were more split. You know, we had 20-some-odd Republicans in the Senate supporting it, I think 24 opposed. In the House, it was pretty evenly divided, but a little bit more skewed to the opposition side. You know, what was excluded, obviously, as I mentioned, there was no funding for Ukraine. There was funding for Israel, but not, you know, the main tranche that lawmakers wanted to do. This does support the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. Overall, this was devoid of a lot of what we call riders, you know, policies that, you know, technically are not relevant to funding government operations that would be more, you know, policy oriented. So, you know, this was in some respects a exercise of restraint, we'll say, where both sides recognized that, you know, to fund government operations, they had to kind of do a bare bones bill. And, you know, I think there's frustration from a number of Republicans who did support it because, you know, this is essentially what Speaker McCarthy agreed to last year that led to his ouster. And, you know, those Republicans are frustrated that really we just spent 6 months arguing about nothing, right? You know, if we knew this was going to happen 6 months ago per that agreement, you know, why did we waste all this time? So I think there are a number of Republicans frustrated that it played out this way. And, you know, the inevitability of it was there the entire time. It's just that, you know, Congress could not get its act together.
It's interesting to hear about the reception of this most recent funding bill, how it came to pass, and I'm sure we'll revisit this conversation a bit later this year. I do want to check in on the campaign trail. There were reports this week pointing to President Biden gaining ground across several key swing states. Anything there you can share with us?
No, absolutely. I think this is noteworthy and something, quite frankly, we were expecting. You know, but maybe we thought it would take a little bit more time. You know, former President Trump has been polling well in those key battleground states. And, you know, as of a few weeks ago, he was outright winning all of those states in polls. But, you know, what I think we recognize is that, you know, that's something that happens. You know, at this point, probably in the 2012 election, you know, polls would have looked good for Mitt Romney, right? But Barack Obama prevailed. I think the reality is that, you know, as this campaign really heats up, because we now have pretty much the nominees locked in, you know, because they both Biden and Trump have secured enough delegates in the primary process, you know, we're seeing this race really take shape. And part of that is, you know, we're going to start seeing, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars spent in advertising. And I think, you know, a lot of tough advertising, reminding people of why maybe they voted against Donald Trump in 2020 will be seen. And that will start to impact voters. And I think these polls to some degree reflect that this race is taking shape. And what we've seen in these states is that were recently polled, like Michigan and Pennsylvania, where, you know, Trump had an outright lead. You know, those actually are now tied. And Wisconsin, where Biden is now leading Trump by 1 point, and he was previously trailing former President Trump by 4. So you're starting to see that shift and tightening of the race that we expected. And, you know, why I think it's too early for people to just say, you know, Trump's got this, even because they see him leading in polls in the critical states that will decide the election.
Well, thank you for the insights there, Shane. And of course, we will continue to track these polls and developments on the campaign trail very closely. Before we wrap up, I do want to acknowledge how this week, earlier this week, we did see President Biden address the tragic fatal incident in Baltimore, this involving the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The president pledge federal support. What might that consist of?
Yeah, so there will be a kind of multiple phases, if you will. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers will be responsible for clearing the channel so that they can get port operations back up and running. You know, this is one of the largest ports in the country and a vital economically to the region. So that will probably be one of the main tasks, obviously, besides the current task by the Coast Guard to try and find, unfortunately, the bodies of those who are missing, those workers that were on the bridge. You know, I think, you know, the longer term, obviously, is rebuilding of a bridge, which, you know, Department of Transportation and Federal Highway Administration will be spearheading and will probably cost north of $1 billion. But what I think is interesting is you're hearing a lot of talk about timeline. You know, I think the port will be open in probably a few weeks. You know, I've heard some of the question, would it be years? That I don't think will happen. I think that will be a little bit quicker than expected. The length of the bridge will be interesting to me. You know, when you look and hear about the time it takes to build a bridge, you hear large numbers like 7 to 10 years. A lot of that time is spent on environmental impact statements, which, You know, if the Biden administration chooses to cut a lot of red tape, that time frame will be consolidated. You may remember about 15 years ago in Minnesota, a bridge collapsed over a river, and that bridge was fully rebuilt in just over a year. And why? Because a lot of the environmental impact study periods were condensed, and they moved and cut red tape to move very quickly. So I think that will be similar here. Now, this is a much longer bridge than that Minnesota bridge, so it will still probably take years to rebuild, but I don't think it's going to be that longer time frame of, 7 to 10 years that you may have heard or read about. But, I think you're seeing a lot of wheels in motion on different fronts, I think, it will take time, but this will be addressed fairly quickly when you kind of look back at things historically.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear about potential timelines with the rebuild and, sadly, as you pointed out, the recovery efforts still ongoing. Though, Shane, I do want to thank you again for spending some time with our listeners, our clients here on the Washington Weekly podcast today. Hope you enjoy opening day. Good luck to your Mets this season, and do look forward to picking back up with our conversation again soon.
Let's go Mets, and thank you, Dan. I look forward to catching up with you, and we'll see how your Yankees do this year.
We need all the help we can get. Thank you again, Shane. Appreciate it. Again, today we have been speaking with Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs US here at UBS. As always, I do want to point out to our listeners, our clients, that you can now locate the latest Washington Weekly publication available for you on ubs.com/Washington Weekly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.